WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events. WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at dana-farber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So as you might have just heard, reading is on the decline, at least according to the National Endowment for the Arts, and David McCullough is predicting dire consequences. But wait a minute, Brian, you're saying. Didn't we just hear a rousing segment 2 days ago on this very show about the best books of 2007? Why, I see the link to it right on your show page, which I go to by hitting www.wnyc.org and clicking on Brian Lehrer's show. And didn't you tell us a couple of weeks ago that IQ scores increase with every generation? How can this be? Yes, you're right. There is a lot of data that need to be reconciled, and we'll try to get into that a bit right now, but we'll also take a look at what a post-literate society might look like, and we'll do that with Caleb Crane, critic at large at The New Yorker magazine. His review/essay, Twilight of the Books, is in that magazine's current issue. Caleb, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
So what kind of due diligence did you do on the NEA study? How did you look at these numbers?
Well, actually, I knew that the study was coming out, and but they don't release anything ahead of time. So I actually spent a lot of the late summer going out and doing essentially what they were doing, but independently. And so when their study came out, it jived with mine, and it was sort of feeling like, okay, I haven't been crazy. I haven't, you know, just come up with this wandering in the wilderness. But I suppose that would be how I fact-checked it, as it were.
And you conclude that Americans are losing the ability to read, not just reading less, but losing the ability to read?
Yeah, to some extent. There's lots of different data that I looked at. I looked at measurements of proficiency, of ability to read, and those seem to have declined, not so much among younger children, but among older children and adults. And then there's some stagnation in book sales when you calculate the number of books rather than the dollar sales. And more distressingly, the NEA study, which actually originally came out in 2004, when people are asked, they say that they're reading less than they were 10 years ago and 20 years ago.
You know what's funny? There seem to be more books published than ever before, and I don't know the actual numbers, but I'll bet there are more books published than ever before. It certainly seems like that coming across my desk, and, you know, a lot of B-list nonfiction that the publishers want us to interview the authors of.
Right. yeah, I didn't really look at the number of titles, per se. That would be something separate. And that seems to be more about, like, what people's tastes are and the changing strategies of the industry about how they publish.
Now, in your New Yorker article, you write about Marianne Wolfe's book, Proust and the Squid, which is about the history and biology of reading. And she writes, "The efficient reading brain, quite literally, has more time to think." What does that mean?
Well, that's what really interested me about her book. I mean, she looks at all these sort of imaging studies where they look at which parts of the brain light up, as it were, as people are reading. And one thing that emerges is that as children learn to read, their brains become more efficient if you're looking purely in terms of where their brains are lighting up. In other words, less of their brain lights up as they become better at it, which suggests that parts of the brain are specializing in the tasks involved and learning to do it more efficiently. And what she suggests is that means that more of the brain is left free to think about what you're reading as you take it in. And I thought that was very suggestive.
And you write that the internet, happily, does not so far seem to be antagonistic to literacy. Researchers recently gave Michigan children and teenagers home computers in exchange for permission to monitor their internet use. The study found that grades and reading scores rose with the amount of time spent online. Even visits to pornography websites improved academic performance. Huh?
Yeah. When I told my editor that, he was like, make sure you put that in the final piece. The thing is that the internet is something recent, and it's sort of in everyone's minds, and I think everyone thinks that the decline in reading has something to do with the growth in the use of the internet. But so far, there doesn't seem to be much data supporting that, not that I could find anyway. In fact, the early data suggests that really heavy internet users are actually the same group of people who are heavy readers. So I kind of ended up thinking that the culprit was rather an older one, cable television. And
yet, as we evolve from heavy blog use to heavy use of video sites like YouTube, that's where you think the concern may escalate.
Yeah, I feel like the internet maybe has been an ally in the recent past, and I wonder if it's going to remain an ally to reading in the future. I feel like more and more blogs that I used to read, I go to, and those same blogs ask me to watch something. So,
Eva in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Caleb Crane from The New Yorker. Hello.
Hello. I'm a professor of philosophy, and I do a lot of writing as well, but nonfiction. And I have to say that I prefer to do a lot of my reading on a screen. I can adjust the size of the type. I can access any of the classics, many of which I have in paper, online. And it's often an easier experience for me to read online. I think technology's always changed. Parchment took over from the stone tablets, and the printing press took over from hand-produced manuscripts. And with each technology, more and more people become literate. And I can imagine, for example, a device like the Kindle, where not only can we see, can we read the books online, but we can switch to audio versions of books. When we're in the middle of doing something else, we hate to put down the book, but we need to move around,
right,
and we can get audio versions. I love audio versions.
Thank you, Eva. So, Caleb, at least for some people, the internet facilitates reading in new and different ways, and even people who may have, you know, progressive disabilities, like not being able to read small book type, you know, get facilitated in their desire to read.
Yeah, no, and I think that's great. And there are things you can do with an electronic text that you can't do with a print text, like find that quote that you remember, but you can't remember exactly which page it's on. And I don't actually think that use of the internet or screen reading is really antagonistic, although I will say that there is some research that shows that people, on average, people don't prefer to read something on screen. If they're given the option, medical students and business school students, when surveyed, said that they preferred to print it out and read it that way.
I wonder if that's generational. I think the younger the person is, the less they care about printing things out, from what I can tell.
Hmm.
So maybe they'll do that again in 10 years and
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, that's the other thing. A lot of these surveys may not be catching what's happening in the moment. There's probably a lag between the research and what the reality is.
Caleb Crane, my guest on WNYC, critic at large for The New Yorker. Maybe you saw his review and kind of cultural muse in this week's edition about what might happen if we become a society that ceases to read books. And part of your concern is about the nature of democracy. And you quote Proust, who wrote, all he can do is give us desires. Reading somehow gives us the boldness to act on them. Such a habit might be quite dangerous for a democracy to lose. What is the relevance to democracy here as you see it?
Well, there was a study released by the government that showed that in 2000, I think it was the 2004 election, proficient readers, 80% of proficient readers voted, and something like 30% of, you know, basic readers. Those are sort of categories that people use, and I'm getting the statistics slightly wrong, but it seems to correlate with, in other words, proficiency in reading, your comfort level in reading seems to have something to do with how likely you are to vote. And I think also it matters in the way that political discussions are carried out. I think that if you're a reader, you're maybe a little less emotional and a little more able to pay attention to the fine details, whereas if you're a viewer, I think you tend maybe to respond to the storyline or to the personalities involved, or just you've already made up your mind and you're just rooting for your team.
So here's a post on our webpage that says, what is the value of taking time to read lengthy nonfiction? Most good nonfiction can be summed up into a few concepts, which can easily be done online.
Well, I would disagree with that. I mean, I think there are certain ideas. I think the written word is kind of a technology that extends the human mind's ability to hold ideas in consciousness at one moment. And I mean, it's an artificial and it's a somewhat difficult technology to learn how to use. But once you use it, it makes it possible for you to take in information of a complexity that you couldn't in a short period of time, and that you couldn't orally or verbally.
And another writer says, in my entire scholastic career, I might have finished 3 books, mainly because it was a chore and I had a timeline before a test and I didn't like it. That turned me off to reading for pleasure, too. I responded to my mother's question of how can I get you to read more by saying, get closed captioning on TV. That was before it was standard. Then at age 23, senior in college, I read Harry Potter skeptically to see if it was really that great. And because of it, I always have a book going from fiction to non-satirical to mystery.
Yeah, I think the Stakhanovite, you know, the school is going to make you read attitude probably is going to backfire. And actually, one interesting thing that I found wading through the numbers was that the children aren't doing so badly. It's in the late teenage years and adults who seem to be no longer reading. I mean, I think children are motivated by, you know, the fear of what's going to happen to them later. And also their environment is more controlled by the adults in their lives. And there are no adults controlling the lives of the adults.
John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, John.
Hi. So I'm enjoying your show, and I'm a professor, so I'm engaged with this with my students. I think books offer a depth of thought that you don't get from magazine articles and online reading. Someone might take 2 to 10 years to write a book, and there's a depth there you're not going to get from snippets of online. On the other hand, we're going to lose that. But on the other hand, we're going to convert to a culture which is visual and which has, as a McLuhanist, you know, I appreciate it's going to offer something different.
John, thank you. And what about that? You know, if you look historically, if you look at the big sweep of history, the printing press is only, 500, 700 years old, whatever it is, out of 10,000 or tens of thousands of years of human history.
Yeah.
Is the last 500 years the only time that we can say that humans were really thinking?
Really thinking? No.
Because that seems to be part of you.
I think actually, you know, there are a lot of people who actually work on, you know, early thought processes, you know, what they might have been like in, like, the Pleistocene era. No, I think thinking can happen with or without reading. But I think literacy changes the way that people think, and that was sort of what I thought was suggestive in Marianne Wolfe's book.
So take us further into that. Maybe you could do the thought experiment with us that you imply in the article, which is if one person decides to watch The Sopranos rather than to read Leonardo Sciascia's novel To Each His Own about the mafia, the culture goes on largely as before. Both viewer and reader are entertaining themselves while learning something about the mafia in the bargain. But. pick it up from there?
Well, I think I chose that novel because I read it actually after I had seen a couple of seasons of The Sopranos. And it seemed like there were a lot of similar themes going on in that. It's more of a novella. But I think that when you're reading something, one thing that I think is different, and I didn't really talk about this in the article, and this is relevant to the mafia shows, is if you come across a scene of violence, I don't think you're as likely to be frightened by it in a kind of visceral way as you might be if you're watching it on TV. I mean, I couldn't watch after about season 3 of The Sopranos because it just got too violent, and I'm not acclimated to that. Mm-hmm. But you can read about these things, and you know, if you look around you, your body isn't going to be reacting to the sight of blood, right? I think that kind of information comes into the brain at a lower level of processing. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, which makes it almost in McLuhan terms. a cool medium rather than a hot medium? So it gives your imagination something to do?
Yeah, it distracts you. It takes up, you become worried and anxious, and but it also frightens you. And I think that if you're taking in information while you're frightened, the way you process it might be somewhat different than if you're taking in, you know, information about violence in a medium that does not itself frighten you.
Frank in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Great show, as
Thank
usual.
You.
I'm an avid reader. I have three kids, two of whom are in college. We read to them when they were children, and I really strongly feel that when you read to young children with excitement and exuberance as a parent, not only do you turn them on to the beauty of the quote-unquote story, whatever it happens to be, but you also give them the sense of being able to sit for a period of time still and let your imagination run wild. And I think one of the biggest problems today, I'm also a school teacher, is that the culture that we live in, the society that we live in, people are always on the move. Adults don't have time to sit with their children. When they get home at night, they basically want to put on a television and numb themselves. They don't have the time, because when you're with your children, you have to be on. You have to really be very active, and you're exhausted after a long day. And as a result, the children in our society also are always on the move. That's why the video games are so hot, in my opinion. That's why YouTube or other quick touch push-button type entertainments are what young people go after. In order to read a book and to really enjoy a book, as you know, you need to be able to sit still and just be comfortable doing that. I find that sometimes when I want to play a piece of music for one of my classes, the students have a very hard time listening.
Yeah, and funny enough, you have to sit still sitting at a computer. You don't have to sit still getting text messages and things like that. So maybe even that is changing just in the last few years as technology continues to evolve. Thank you for your call, Frank. And Andrea in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I'm a professor at Hofstra of Literacy Studies, and we deal with this question every day about technology and the impact on reading. And I'm just very skeptical about statistics that talk about reading proficiency, because a lot of the standardized tests that are being used to come up with those numbers have been shown that they're deeply flawed. In other words, like, they're assessing something that's not actual reading. Like your guest was saying, they're not assessing children reading a whole book. They're assessing, you know, small passages with multiple questions. So there's a big discussion about whether that constitutes reading or not.
Caleb Crane, do you have an opinion about that?
Yeah, I mean, no test is perfect. And the tests that I was mostly looking at were the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And they seem pretty thorough and pretty well thought out, and they've been administered since the 1970s, and they were updated, I think, in the, I forget when, late 80s. But, I mean, the other thing is that for this article, I wasn't just looking at one set of data. I mean, I was looking at survey results, at polling, at, you know, at other signs that I thought, well, maybe this will show tell me something about people's reading habits.
Yeah, because just the other comment that I wanted to say was that I agree. I mean, technology has opened the door for adolescents to do just so many things with internet technology, with electronic literacies. And yeah, I think that we need to rethink the way we're assessing literacy if we want to include all of those complexities.
So, Andrea, let me throw you one stat from Caleb's article from the Education Department. It says in 1992, 54% of 12th graders told the Department of Education that they talked about their reading with friends at least once a week. By 2005, only 37% said they did that. That is a tremendous decline in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, and I don't blame them, because I think that what's happening in schools is that while, you know, while adolescents and teenagers are exploring different types of media and different types of literacy, in schools they're not being engaged with the materials that are being presented. So I think that that's probably an accurate portrayal, you know, of what they're commenting about their literacies.
Andrea, thank you very much. And Caleb Crane, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for a provocative piece in The New Yorker this week. I'll just go out with this one email that just came in that says, I bought a used copy of a book called How to Read and Why by Harold Bloom. It's been sitting on my shelf unopened for 2 years now and always makes me feel slightly guilty when I look at the title. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. All right. Forget about all the stop shopping stuff. What cool gifts did you find this holiday season? Help out some people who are about to panic because Christmas is just a few days away. 212-433-WNYC.